For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
The Gospel of Mark here tonight. And we're going to read a story tonight in chapter 14 where people were asking this question, why this waste? There's actually three versions of this story in John, Mark, and Matthew. So we'll start in Mark, but we'll draw in whatever we can from the others as well. The story starts in verse 1. It says, "Now 2 days before the Passover celebration of the festival of unleavened bread, the leading priests and teachers of the religious law were still looking for an opportunity to capture Jesus secretly and put him to death. But not during the Passover, they agreed, for there will be a riot. Meanwhile, Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon, a man who had leprosy. During supper, a woman came in with a beautiful jar of expensive perfume. She broke the seal and poured the perfume over his head. Some of those at the table were indignant. 'Why was this expensive perfume wasted?' they asked. 'She could have sold it for a small fortune and given the money to the poor.' And they scolded her harshly. But Jesus said, 'Leave her alone. Why berate her for doing such a good thing to me? You will always have the poor among you, and you can help them whenever you want to, but I will not be with you much longer. She has done what she could, and she has anointed my body for burial ahead of time. I assure you, whenever the good news is preached throughout the world, this woman's deed will be talked about in memory of her.'" The woman turns out to be Mary, the sister of Martha. That's not clear from this account, but that comes out in John. Let's go back to verse 3 and just kind of think through some of the elements of this unusual story. This perfume, this ointment, was spikenard ointment, which had to be imported. And ancient people spent a great deal for spices and essences, oils, way more than we do today. And this had been put in one of these carved alabaster. This phial was made out of alabaster, so, you know, they carve a narrow neck, and then once you break the neck, it is poured out. That's what she did. And so once she had done this, she couldn't screw the lid back on and keep the rest. It was irretrievable. And in one moment of time, it was gone. We might ask ourselves, what is Mary doing with something like this? In one of the Gospels, in two of the Gospels, the value is given at 300 denarii for this vial of perfume or ointment. Okay, a denarius is what a guy would earn, a full-grown man, if he was out working for a day. So 300 of those, it would take you basically a year to earn enough money in their world to buy this thing. Now, of course, they earned a lot less than we do, but still a year is a year. So, you know, we'd have to say this was, what, $50,000, $100,000, this treasure that she poured out. And probably it meant a lot more to them than it would to us, even the net. Because, you know, most of their money, most of what they earned went to buy food. Whereas just a small percentage of our income, we're so wealthy that we, you know, we only spend 10% of our income on food. They were spending 80%, so it was pretty hard to save any money at all. And when you had something like this, that was something else. Mary and Martha were not wealthy. They owned a home with their brother Lazarus. So the three of them are living together in a house that Jesus visited. And so they weren't destitute either. They were probably of the merchant class or the working class. Martha is back preparing dinner for Jesus when he visits there, if you know that, remember that one story. So they, you know, if they were the wealthy in this society, if you were wealthy, that would have been done by a servant. So the fact that they did their own work and stuff showed that they weren't affluent or anything. They were, and by our standards, they would have been very poor indeed. What's she doing with a treasure like this? This has to do with a lot of, this was actually not too uncommon, you know, the way they handled retirement in the ancient world. Particularly for women. There were no, you know, 401k deals. There was no Social Security. There was nothing to fall back on. And especially if you are a woman, because women, you know, were not educated at all in this culture. They weren't acceptable for most kinds of work. So if a woman became a widow at a fairly old age, it was really hard going. She was going to have to sew things and try to sell them in the market or something. It was going to be very low income, very tough to get by, and if she was, you know, became sick or disabled, only family could really sustain her. So what a lot of families did for their daughters is that they would have these little treasures that they would pass down, a dowry that they would will to their daughters. And a lot of women had one or two of these things. It could be an object, a gold chain, or a file of spikenard ointment that's worth a lot of money. So if she ended up in a bad spot later in life, she could always sell this and survive on the income from that. This is why a relatively poor woman like Mary had something like this in her possession. It was her security. It was her future. And in a moment, perhaps somewhat impulsive, she poured it out on Christ, and boom, it was gone. So it's a striking event seen in its own context. Now the people at the table were indignant, and they're saying, "That was a waste, you foolish woman. What are you doing? Oh my God, it's already, she broke it, it's out. What a waste. You know, we could have used this money for something else. What about the poor? What about that?" And they just did not think this was a good idea at all. And so a lot of this analyzing this story has to do with analyzing, what does waste mean? What does it mean when you waste it? Among other things, waste can be understood as paying too much when you get too little. You know, it's a quarter candy bar, you paid a dollar, you wasted 75 cents. Giving too much, you know, the job, half an hour should have been long enough to get the job done. You took 2 hours to do it, you wasted an hour and a half. And so it's probably in that sense, giving too much for something when you could have given less is the sense of waste that's intended here. And so some of the people at the table, we read, were indignant. And the first question that comes to mind there, who were these people that were saying this? We can go to the account in John to learn about that. Here we see it's the same story, right? Right before Passover, going to Lazarus. There's Martha. And Mary, therefore, took a pound of very costly, pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus, wiped his feet. And we read, but Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples sitting, intending to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not so? Why this waste?" Oh, it was Judas. Well, that really fits, doesn't it? Oh, yeah. Good old Judas, already intending to betray him. You know, Judas looked at Jesus Christ on the one hand, 300 denarii on the other, and to him, no way. That's a waste right there. Truthfully, though, when you think about Judas, he was not a believer. That must be the case. You know, if you knew who Jesus was, if you believed in who he was, then you wouldn't sell him into betrayal, would you? I mean, his actions, we don't have any place in the Gospels where Judas speaks and tells us what his thoughts were or anything like that. But his actions speak louder than any words really could. It's clear he just didn't know or believe who Jesus was. In all likelihood, Judas was like a lot of people who began to follow Jesus. You know, there was these multitudes following Jesus at one point. Most of them deserted him. And the thing that they found attractive in Jesus, not only was his miracle-working power, they could tell he had something to do with God, but it was also this belief that any day now he's going to start using these powers to overthrow the Romans, and he's going to, you know, take over the world and start the kingdom of God, as promised in the Old Testament for King Messiah. We saw a couple weeks ago how James and John came groveling up saying, "Can we sit on your right hand and your left when you take power in your kingdom?" Right? So Judas wasn't the only person. You know, there were a lot of people who were kind of hanging around Jesus, hoping to get a piece of the action when he took over. And Judas was probably like the others in this regard. As it became increasingly clear, though, that this was not what Jesus was going to do, and particularly the cleansing of the temple at the beginning of the last week of his life, where he completely alienated all the leadership of Israel at that point and practically turned himself into a fugitive, it was clear that Jesus just wasn't expanding his base, he wasn't going to win the election, and it wasn't going to happen. He wasn't really even interested in taking over power. And at this point, guys like Judas sat there and thought, oh man, I've been following him for 3 years, and what do I have to show for it? Nothing. I've blown it. And he decided to get from it what he could. You know, it's interesting to think about Judas. He must have been pretty good. The other disciples couldn't tell that he wasn't a believer. They thought he was one of them. Even at the Last Supper, Jesus says, you know, one of you sitting here is going to betray me pretty soon. And you would just expect, you know, 11 heads to rotate over to Judas and be like, oh, dude. So it's come to that. No, not even one, not even somebody, you know, I've got an idea, is it Judas? No. They sat there and they said, Lord, it's not me, is it? They were more willing to doubt themselves than they were Judas. That's how good he looked. So you really couldn't tell the difference on the outside. A huge difference inside, though. We pick up our modern media and History Channel and all the others today are kind of, I've turned Judas into almost a hero. Because, you know, he did the dirty work, he did the wet work that was needed, and that he was kind of compelled to do this. That's not true at all. Ask yourself this. If Judas was doing this because he thought Jesus wanted him to, or because he was somehow fated to do this, where did the 30 pieces of silver fit in? What does that have to do with anything? That was the profit motive right there. You know, that'd be like a couple $1,000 for us. And Judas figured, okay, I've wasted 3 years, but at least I can get a little cash and, you know, cover some of my expenses that way. He did this for money. It's very clear. Yeah, you had a change of heart later on. That wasn't that good either, though, because it was the wrong kind of change of heart. Judas was not a hero. Jesus called him the son of perdition. Jesus said, didn't I choose 12 of you, and yet one of you is a devil? He knew that Judas's heart was black, that was not with him all the way along. Well, Judas then really stands for the world that does not know God in this story. To Judas, it was a waste to pour such expensive perfume on Jesus. On the other hand, really, even if it had been water she poured on him, that would have been a waste as well. Because Judas had no value for Christ. He didn't know Christ, really. And the world, away from God, not knowing Christ personally, tends to view any sacrificial act done on, you know, for Christ is a waste. And I know many of us sitting here have heard this from friends and family and so forth. I remember in California one time I was working for an older couple. This couple really took a liking to me for some reason, and I worked in their apartment complex. I was their maintenance guy there. And they used to actually have me come in and sit around and talk with them and feed me steak and stuff instead of working, which was fine with me. Because they just, I don't know, I think I was like a surrogate son to them or something like that. But when it was coming near the time for me to leave, I told them, you know, in a couple months I'm going to be out of here. And they said, well, we have a little proposal on that. And they had heard me talk about possibly getting a doctorate in history and becoming a prof. And they said, we would like to set you up, you know, with one of these luxury apartments in the complex there. Let you have one of those for your own. We'll pay you this salary, and we'll help you go to school. You know, UCLA is a great place to get a doctorate, and you can stay here. And I was like, you know, that's a wonderful offer and everything, but I basically broke the news that that's not going to happen because I got to go back to Columbus. And I'm like, well, Columbus, Ohio. You know that, you know, Californians' attitude toward a place like Columbus is just like, well, you know, where even is that? They said, well, why are you going to go back there? And I said, well, I've talked to you before about my views on God and stuff, and there's this group, it's really only 40 or 50 students, but I want to go back and work with them and try to get a Christian thing going there in Columbus. And they're like, well, how are you going to make your, you know, how are you going to make your living? And I said, I'm thinking about painting houses. I don't know. I'm just going to find something. And you could just see on their face this, why this waste? Why this waste? And they said, you know, you seem like you're so sharp. You should be a professor. You should do this. You should do that. I can't believe you're talking about going and doing something like that. Why this waste? The underlying agenda, though, for Judas, and really for most of the world, is what's good for me. And by extension, what's good for you. So they want, you know, people will live. And we've talked about how the main ethos in the world is going out and getting whatever I can for myself. And then they want people that they like to live that way too. In this account, it becomes pretty clear with Judas, because we read in verse 6 that Judas said this, not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. Oh, man. So this was pure self-serving, actually, and deceit to boot. I don't know how they found this out. Jesus must have told them later. Or maybe they did the accounting after he was dead. But I'm sure they didn't know it at the time. I'm sure the rest of the disciples didn't know it. Anyway, so there is a thing here, and we have to be, basically, if you're a follower of Christ, you can hardly expect someone to understand why you attach so much importance to your relationship with Christ when that person has never met Christ and has no idea what you're talking about. And so it's not too surprising to find that people who don't know Christ feel like any act of, particularly, it's one thing if you want to go to church, if you feel like that's helpful for you or whatever, that's fine. But at any point where it starts to become sacrificial, where you start to seem like you're getting carried away, well, you know, we talk about commitment. We talk about dedication in our culture. I think our culture has a problem, a serious problem with any kind of commitment when it comes to something like Christ. And yet we don't really have a problem with commitment per se. You know, you can imagine a young guy coming forward and saying, well, I've decided to be an Olympic athlete because, you know, I'm really good at high jumps, so I'm going to go out and I'm going for the Olympics. I'm going to go for the gold. Now, that means that for the next 10 years, you know, I'm 13 now, and so for the next 10 years, I'm going to take 6 hours of each day for training. I'll have to leave regular school and be tutored, and it'll be a very strange life for me, leave all my friends. I'll be withstanding multiple injuries along the way, but I'll just have to recover from those because I want to be an Olympic athlete. And to that, you know, our culture would say, yeah, yeah, that's awesome. Well, you got to be dedicated, you know. You got to work if you want something good like that. You know, I'm going to be a doctor. I'll have to spend, you know, the next 8 years, practically to the exclusion of all else. I'll have to be working 90 hours a week during part of that time. And again, yeah, yeah, go for it. Make something of yourself. Of course, there's got to be sacrifice. If you want something that sweet, you know, yeah, no pain, no gain. Hey, we're all over that. The truth is, we don't have any problem with dedication, sacrifice. You watch the up close and personals at the Olympic Games, you know, it's like, aw, such hard work, such dedication, it's beautiful. We admire that. Now we come along and say, yeah, you know, I've decided to spend yet another night during my week because I'm going to start taking a class. I want to become equipped to become a Christian worker and become a servant of God. And we'll get this sort of like, you know, yeah. Yeah, well, are you sure you thought about this? Because, you know, it's like, it just maybe seems like you're getting a little carried away. And it'd be like, wait a minute. You know, serving God's way more important than jumping over a bar. A skill that I'll never be able to use the rest of my life. I mean, I'm talking about something here that could change the course of eternal history, that could affect people's lives in a lasting way. Yeah, I understand that, but, you know, I just think you need to weigh this, and, you know, you need to take your time. I don't think you, you know, and all of a sudden, when it has to do with Christ, it's like, oh, well, I don't know, it sounds a little fanatical, it sounds a little questionable, and we've got a problem. But it's not that we have a problem with being dedicated and sold out. Judas sure was having a problem when he saw that 300 denarii go flying out the window. He was hoping to get a piece of that himself. Jesus had his own perspective on wasting your life. He tells us a story in Luke chapter 12 about this. This story goes that the land of a certain rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, now what am I going to do since I don't even have enough space to store my crops? Well, he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns, and then I'll build larger ones, and there I can store all my grain and all my goods. Wow, so he's really, this company's growing, isn't it? I can't even fit all my, you know, that was wealth for them, was agricultural produce, grain, that would be like better than money. And so, yeah, he's having to build all these big granaries. This business is booming. This guy is really successful. And then he says, I'll say to my soul, soul, you've laid up many goods for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. I got so much money now, build 7 of these granaries. I don't even know how I'm going to spend the money. I've got so much of it, I guess I'll just party. There's nothing left to do but party. Well, God comes along at that point, and he says, you fool! This very night, your soul is required of you. And now who's going to own all of this that you've prepared? And Jesus says, so is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. This man was highly successful. He, quote, made something of himself. He built this agricultural empire up. This would have been one of the most admired people in his culture. To him, though, God says, you fool! And God's really saying, why this waste? You want to talk about waste, all right? Here's a guy that was clearly sharp, he had drive, he had capability. And what does he expend his life on? Acquisition of money. Well, that makes all kinds of sense for some reason in our world, but all of a sudden God shows up and he says, guess what? It doesn't make sense anymore. This is the end of your life, buddy. And all of your life that you poured into this, now, boosh, it's gone. Somebody else gets to own that stuff. You come here. And that is a tragic, foolish waste. You want to talk about waste? Here it is, right here. Wasting your life on something that you can never hold for very long. And people do this in a lot of areas. Yes, people live for material avarice, and that's a waste of a life. People live on a base of pride. You know, we see people who are so wealthy that they couldn't really spend their money if they tried, and we ask, why do you still try to earn even more? And they're kind of, we often hear the reply that, you know, well, the toys and the you know, the dollars is kind of a way of keeping score. It's really all about, I want to be the winner of the game. I want to show that I'm important, that I can do this. And we do this in a variety of different ways. But it's competing with other people to try to gain a sense of importance for yourself. How many silos do you have? I got 7. And they're all full. About that. Sensual experience. To eat, drink, and be merry, and ... all the other that goes with it. Just trying to pleasure my body. Hedonism. A lot of people turn to this. People live for this. That's a waste of life. All of these are a waste of life for one simple reason. They're all temporary. I'm not going to say there's no pleasure in hedonistic experience. That's not really true. You can have some pleasures that way. I'm not going to say that it's no fun to be rich. I wouldn't know, but I think it must be. It's probably not that bad. That's really not the point. The point is you get all of these benefits or things that seem like, you know, good things, and then boom, all of a sudden you have nothing. What if this guy, this farmer, had built these 7 granaries knowingly over a bed of quicksand and didn't even lay a foundation? And then, you know, a couple of years after they were built, they all tipped over and spilled his grain all over the place into the mud. Man, that would be dumb. People would be like, you idiot. You build nice granaries like that? You didn't even get a foundation down in there? You should know that's not going to last. Well, that really would be stupid. Nobody's that stupid, are they? Wait a minute. Whoa, wait a minute. That's really the same thing, though, isn't it? Yeah, it would be really dumb to build granaries in such a way they fall over in a couple of years, but what's the difference between that and building them so they fall over after 50 years? The point is, they fall over. That's the point. And what God has for us doesn't fall over. And that's why when you expand your life on that temporal value system, it's waste, a tragic waste of life. Going to go to Matthew now. Turns out Judas wasn't the only one, though, that was complaining. Here we are at Bethany, and here we are at Bethany, and a woman came up to me and all about smiling. But the disciples were indignant, and they said, why this way? So it wasn't just Judas. Oh, man. So the other disciple, maybe he led the way, but they joined in. Yeah, it wasn't just Judas. These are the disciples, they're Christian believers. They know who Jesus is. We just heard Peter and the others talking about, you're the Messiah, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And yet, even they apparently thought, but this is really too much. You know, it's like Mary, okay, Mary, this is a nice sentiment, but I mean, oh my God. All right, get a grip. Do you realize how valuable that was? I mean, it's not like we're covered in money here. And, you know, even Christian believers may very well bust out with this same sense that, okay, I'm glad you're enjoying your religion, but really, you know, let's not get carried away. And let's keep first things first, because, you know, your career, that's what really matters. And then so forth. Yes, we'll hear that still today. As a matter of fact, particularly in American Christianity, it seems like the sort of very measured, short-armed version of Christianity is the standard. I mean, that's pretty popular. We're finding even in our own church that a lot of people, we still see people coming to Christ every year in large numbers, but it seems like it's harder and harder to convince people that it makes sense to sell out to Jesus Christ. That seems like once people start hearing that, oh, I don't know, man. And for some reason, they can't connect the dots between, okay, so you've met the risen Christ, God's Son who died for you, who you're going to be with forever. And they can't connect the dots that then maybe I should sell out and waste myself for him. That doesn't seem to compute. In a lot of ways, this is even stranger, far stranger than Judas. At least Judas didn't know Christ. Judas didn't believe in Christ. You can see why he would consider this a waste. But for those who actually know Christ, yeah, we'll still hear this today. We still will. I got into an interesting session on the internet with a group of people who were ex-Xenos people, and they were crabbing at me about how Xenos thinks you have to be all committed and stuff like that. And I was like, you don't have to, but my gosh, you know, think about who we're dealing with here. That's an interesting point to ponder right there. Jesus, let's read his perspective on this. He doesn't seem to agree with the others. He says, leave her alone. She's done something good for me. You're criticizing her because she did something good for me. She's done what she could, and she has anointed my body for burial ahead of time. Okay, now that's another cultural illusion there that we need to unfold a little bit. In the ancient world, people anointed dead people's bodies. Now, this seems kind of creepy to us, because when we have someone die, they're just shipped away to the mortuary, and they pump the polymers in and embalm people, and we think that's the way to do it. And then you don't see them unless maybe it's all with flowers and stuff. They were different, okay? Their way, part of their way of grappling with the departure and loss of a loved one is that they would anoint their body. They would rub them down with these spices and oils and stuff. And it was a way to show kind of parting affection and to see them off. And I guess just deal with your own grief that way. And it was a way to honor their memory as well, to anoint their body. Of course, it did no good for the body. The person's dead. It's really for the people doing it. It's for their sake. Well, interestingly, Jesus says, properly understood, this, she's really anointed my body for burial. I don't know whether she knew that or not, but Jesus said that's the interpretation he put on it. Interestingly, a number of women wanted to do this, didn't they? There were four of them that went out not just a few days after this event with their spices and oils, and they were ready to anoint the body of Jesus. But what? They were too late. He'd already risen. And so it turned out that of all the people that would have liked to do this, the only one who actually did was Mary. Mary, we should think about Mary. Jesus says, I assure you, whenever the good news is preached throughout the world, this woman's deed will be talked about in her memory. So Jesus clearly thinks that there's something here that should be imitated. He thinks that there was something really good about this. And I'm sure that it's something in the heart. It isn't the outward act he's trying to extol, but it's what it reveals about something in the heart. Yeah, Mary, interesting gal. She did this. You know, she had just had a pretty profound experience. If you follow the chronology there, which John seems to unfold best, this event was probably only a matter of days after Jesus had come and raised her brother from the dead, Lazarus. Yeah, he had been dead for 4 days. Mary, completely despairing, she was even seems to be rebuking Christ for, you know, if only you had been here, you could have done something. Weeping, inconsolable, and he told her, you know, your brother's going to live. And she said, I know, we're all going to live in the afterlife and all that, you know. And Jesus says, I am the resurrection, I am the life. And he used this as a kind of a teaching thing to show that he had come to bring eternal life to people. That's why Jesus came, was to open the door for us to know God in a personal way. It was his death on the cross that makes this possible. You know, God stands apart from us. He can't accept our morally evil and ambiguous lives. And so he can't come into close fellowship with us because of his just nature. And in Jesus, God came and basically said, I'm going to take that problem onto myself. And at the cross, he suffered God's judgment for human sin. Now, anyone that wants to know God can simply accept that gift from Christ and come to God, and the door is wide open for a direct personal relationship. The Spirit of God actually enters us. Anyway, Jesus demonstrated that, and he said, Lazarus, come up. And the next thing she knew, her brother, who they had already anointed and wrapped up in cloth and buried in a hole, gets up and starts walking out. Oh, she knew who Jesus was, all right. Now, that's called an encounter with Christ. When he raises your brother, who you personally buried after 4 days, and he's been dead for 4 days. And Jesus comes, that's the power of God himself. Nothing less could do that. And so, behind this incredible, impulsive, and maybe seemingly crazy act that she did here with her phial of nard, is the fact that she had just had this incredible encounter with Christ, and she knew right down to the tips of her toes who this was. Well, there must have been incredible gratitude in her heart for, you know, him raising her brother. but also just an overwhelming realization that, you know, we've really appreciated his teachings. We thought Jesus was awesome, but we had no idea who we were dealing with here. And now she grasped it. That's what you need, frankly. If you're listening to this whole discussion, this idea of wasting your life on Jesus Christ, it's just, it will never make sense to you until you have an encounter with Christ yourself. It's not until you meet Christ in a personal way and see for yourself who he really is that all of the tumblers begin to lock into place and we start to think, oh, so that's why. Well, I guess this makes a heck of a lot. This is not waste. This makes more sense than I thought it did. It's interesting to ponder with Mary. She's still around. I mean, she's not on earth here, but I believe in the afterlife. I think she's still alive. I believe she's with Christ. As a matter of fact, those of us that get to go to heaven someday could probably put in a request to see Mary. We could probably have a little talk with her. Or maybe we'll just run into her on the street. That's possible, too. Oh, this is Mary. She's the one with the nard. Oh, wow. And we could be probably like, you know, man, Mary, yes. Well, I can't believe you wasted 300 neri on that. I mean, that must have really taken a lot of guts. And she'd be, you know, what would she be saying? What would she be saying? She'd be like, you think I care about 300 neri? Look around you, pal. I wish I could have done that 10 times over. Heck no, she's not going to regret this act. And see, I believe that's really the way it is. The guy with the 7 barns, I don't know whether he made it or not. Maybe, let's say he did. It's possible. God's the God of grace. He may have been a believer. If we run into him, we're going to get the other reply. So how do you feel about your life direction while you were there? He'd be like, man, I blew it. I thought those granaries mattered for some reason. I can't remember why I thought that. I was all caught up in it. All the important things were going by in my life. I didn't make any difference spiritually in the world. I had no impact for God. I blew it. Yeah, he'll know that. Well, things look a little different when you pass out of the temporal into the eternal. And Jesus is trying to teach us in this. Why does he say what she's done will be spoken of everywhere in memory? It's because he's trying to connect us with, he's saying, connect the dots, right? See where you're headed and start lining up for that right now. Then we read in John 12:3, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. That's an interesting, you know, John who wrote this was actually there that day. And I'll bet he's writing and he thinks back and he's like, yeah, I remember that smell, boy. Did that stuff ever smell? And he's writing this down. But it makes you wonder too. Chinese author Watchman Nee, who I enjoy reading, has a little problem with allegorical interpretation sometimes slips into that. And maybe he does on this passage too, because he thinks that this permeating odor going out through the house sort of reminded him of some other passages. And that the point being, you know, to be effective, to have an impact for Christ, that you have to kind of be like Mary. And you have to be willing to waste yourself on Christ. And you also have to be ready, willing to break the alabaster vial. It's got to be broken. You can't keep it unbroken and still pour out the nard. It's got to be kind of a giving over of yourself in the ultimate sense. And I'm tempted to think he might have a point here. Well, it is a point. I mean, we could back this up from other scriptures anyway. I don't know whether it's being said with this. It is interesting to think of how this odor was just flowing out. And it kind of reminds you of other passages where he talks about us having the odor of Christ, manifesting the presence of Christ. And it's funny that some people do this a lot more than others do. Sometimes it doesn't seem to be really directly related to how sharp they look or how gifted they are or how smart they are, how charismatic they are. It's funny because you'll see people that are very charismatic, smart, gifted, seem like they would just be, you know, these guys are going to just be like a bulldozer through the world for God. And they have very little impact. Very little, really. And then others seem to just have overwhelming impact, incredible impact. And we wonder, what's the difference? I think it maybe often is just this. That it is this, in fact. Yeah. We talked earlier in Mark about when Jesus gave the challenge about losing everything to follow me, and he said, if salt has lost its savor, what good is it? Can't even taste it anymore, right? And he connected that idea of the salt losing its savor to people who weren't willing to give over their life in an unreserved way to Christ. These decisions are very profound. They're inward. No one else can tell where you're at on this. No one should try to judge other people. I don't think on this that something between each individual and God. He will call us out at certain points. And we just will realize in a moment of time, I'm not sure that I'm willing to risk this, God, even for you, because it's just too important to me. And we're really saying, you know, I just don't trust you enough to do that, God. I don't trust you enough to give this over to you. And so there's a saying you hear that if Christ isn't Lord of all, he isn't Lord at all. Because it's that specific aspect that we're holding back, that we won't give over, that kind of says it all, which is, God, I don't trust you with my life. So it could be different things for different people. It's really hard to generalize. I brought us a story along tonight of a brother right here in our own church who struggled and basically had an experience along these lines that many of his relatives and secular friends considered sheer waste. They were crying out, just singing like these guys, why this waste? Whoa. Here was a guy, real sharp, real personable guy, a doer, a successful guy, has a career as an engineer, decides to change and become an attorney. He's on the partnership track at a big law firm. You know what that means. You reach the partnership in a big law firm, it's, boy, that's the bucks there. Most of these people are millionaires. So he's heading down that track, so it's like everybody's like, yeah, go, work, dedication, yes, go for it, partnership in a big firm like that, it'll be awesome. All of a sudden, he takes a radical change of course because of Jesus Christ. Well, I'll let him tell you the story.
Went to law school, started in 93, and I actually had a career as an engineer prior to that, so my undergraduate degree is in engineering. And worked as an engineer for Honda for 7 years. Quit that, went to law school at Ohio State, and then, after law school, went to work for Squire Sanders and Dempsey, a big multinational law firm that has an office here in Columbus. That is about the same time that we started coming to Xenos, within a few months after I'd accepted the position there. And it wasn't really like any particular, event. It's just this process of then learning all these truths about who Christ is and who I was and how he viewed me, and just really understanding that on a deep level, and then looking at the law firm situation in a whole different light and seeing that the goal of being in a big law firm is to become partner. I saw a lot of divorces in the partners. I saw a lot of partners working, long hours, not knowing their kids, and relational alienation. Of course, it doesn't describe 100% of the partners, but it does describe the majority of them. And so it became just really, that tension of, we want you to bill, we want you to commit, we want you to do this and make this your number one priority. I had lunch with a partner who was my mentor, and he, he was telling me that, it seems like, that the partners don't feel that you have this desire to achieve at the law firm the way that we would like you to have, and that, it was said of me that I didn't have the fire in the belly to become a partner, and I recognized what he said was true. My priorities had shifted, and it wasn't exactly my number one priority or even my second priority in life. And so I told him that very, very, directly. I said that, being a partner, that, work in general is not my top priority in life. My top priority is God and what he's doing in my life and my family. And then it's my work life. And he told me straight out that he said, well, the firm would definitely like to have that second position, and, you know, to be really honest with you, John, they want that first position too. And, you know, it was just, it couldn't be more clear. I mean, the decision was made for me at that time, because where I was placing my priorities and the way I wanted to live my life, and the way that, it was being presented to me that what this firm wanted was just in total opposition to each other, and something had to give, and it wasn't going to be God's position in my life. There really is so many different paths. I mean, there's people from that firm who have been federal court judges. There are people who have, you know, gone into politics. Greg Leshetka came out of that law firm. So there's a lot of, there's just a variety of different paths it could take. Obviously, there's a substantial portion of people that didn't get that kind of fame and notoriety, but just, you know, the incomes, you know, in very substantial incomes in the homes in Muirfield and New Albany and things like that are kind of the norm in the partnership ranks. When I really soberly reflect on what I've given up, I really haven't given up anything at all. I have a relationship with my wife and my children that I think is rare in this world, and I think would be almost unheard of in a firm of that size. I've been blessed with the opportunity to lead a home church of people who are committed to growing with Christ, and to teach at the home church meetings, and watch people accept Christ, watch people make commitments to Christ. Christ is impacting people's lives in a very positive way. The result of that I see is people are genuinely happy, genuinely excited, genuinely fulfilled with how their life is going, and that's been my experience as well, is that sense of fulfillment of this is really the way that God has intended for people to live in relationship with one another, and striving to conform to His will and recognizing His love for us and walking with Him as great as possible. I mean, so when you ask me what I've given up, I mean, the big picture is I've really given up nothing. I heard from one of my relatives that my parents thought I was going through a phase, and that I would eventually just kind of get out of it and, you know, go on and just be like a normal person. So far the phase has lasted 6 years, so I'm hoping it doesn't end.
Well, that actual interview was 3 years ago, so it's been going on for 9 years now. He still makes a living. He's not hurting. I mean, yeah, he's probably not as rich as he would have been, but Christ isn't going to abandon us out to nothingness or anything like that, but there is this whole question of priorities in your life. 2 Corinthians 2:14 is where Paul talks about, through us God manifests the aroma of Christ in every place. Some people see this as the sweetest smell they've ever seen. Others think it's a choking gas, you know, but it's an impression that's given off from some people. People have an impression of spirituality, an impression of Jesus Christ. And it makes them curious, makes them want to know what that is. Boy, I've prayed for this to God. I've prayed that God would manifest that aroma through me. I guess He has some at some points, probably should have done a lot more, but I think a lot of us would like to see that. A lot of us would like to have some sort of an impact. You know, as Wayne shared with us a few weeks back, we can't take anything with us when we go except other people. They're going to come with us. And something to think about there. And there are people who desperately need to know God all around us. The path of life that John's taken, where he's working with people and their spiritual lives and counseling them, teaching them, stuff like that. I think it's beautiful. I just think it's awesome, clearly. And I think that 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, I think he will be just as clear on that decision. It'll be just as clear then that this was the right direction to go. We ought to all think about this. Knowing Christ, yeah, it can impact you, and you find yourself doing things you never thought you would before. I'm going to draw a line there for tonight on why this weighs. All right, who's got a thought to add or a question or something like that? Okay?
Just made me think when you talked about meeting Mary on the street in heaven, I could see myself being introduced to her and her saying, well, so tell me, what sacrifices did you make for the Lord? And I'm afraid I would be like a deer in the headlights at that point, because I don't think I could come up with anything to match what she did. But it's really good to get those kind of wake-up calls.
Yeah.
Regularly, because I tend to fall asleep at the switch, and that was kind of like wake up and pay attention.
Yeah, the difference between Mary and those Christians that are where they are saying this is a waste is that they wanted to be all measured, and spend their time thinking about how much did we really need to do here. And she just lost track of the boundaries, right? I mean, it was just everything for her. And there is a huge difference there when it becomes sacrificial. How about here?
Hi, thanks for that great teaching. I had to stop and think about when I first came to Christ and was talking to my husband, who wasn't a believer at the time, and he was saying to me, he thought that would be, I talked about committing, coming to CT and home church and everything, and his comment was that that would be okay as long as I didn't get too radical. And I remember thinking, I think I already am, but I wasn't going to tell him that. And then 2 years later, he came to Christ. And it was so cool because shortly thereafter, there was a call to help some missionaries with their finances. And he gave all of our savings. And I was like, wait a minute. Some of that money was supposed to be for our vacation. There's a long story behind that, too. But I was just, taken back that he did that. And I thought later, that heart that he had to give, like that was a heart that I didn't have. And I started questioning, my values and what I would sacrifice. And the cool thing about it is that, of course, God used that in a good way. And then later, we were approached by somebody who owned a timeshare and offered us a vacation that we never could have afforded for free.
Wow.
So, I mean, there were so many
things happening.
God gave
you a little message right there, didn't he?
Yeah. So it was very cool, though. I think what I learned was to question, it was a good lesson for me to see how sacrificial my husband had been without thinking, and it was good for me to.
Well, that's
think
a good
about
object
that.
Lesson. That really illustrates the difference in perspective you can have when you don't know Christ, where just don't put too much into this, versus when you know Him, and now it's like, wait a minute, let's go for it. Yeah, completely different perspective. How about back there?
Yeah, Dennis, I was wondering, at the beginning of the story there where the Judas and the other disciples were saying, oh, what a waste, you waste this year of wages. I was just wondering, I found in my life that when I have more, I don't have to pay the bills or wait till my paycheck to pay the bills, if there's a buffer zone, it makes me, I feel more comfortable, all right, I feel more secure. And I was just wondering if maybe the disciples were thinking, hey, if we had this money, we wouldn't have to, depend on, God daily for our provision, that we'd have this money. And I find that lots of times I find into feeling secure because of the provisions I have instead of the provider.
Yeah, I do. I think there's a lot of that. And I think one of the reasons that people get hung up on earning and saving and stuffing their mattresses with money is all about that sense of security. And I'm sure that's probably part of what the guy with the seven silos was feeling, is that, you got to provide for the future, and he did that. But what Jesus' story illustrates is there is no such thing as financial security. There can be no security in finances. We believe in eternal security. There you can be secure, and that's where we need to draw our security from. Paul put it in one passage, he says, we came into the world naked, and we're going to leave it that way also.
So in the meantime, you know, as long as we have enough to eat and a place to live and the basics, you know, we should be satisfied with that and not fall into this thing about that so many people do, where they're going to try to get this secure feeling from being rich. I know people in America hate to hear that, but that's what the Bible teaches. All right, one more.
Yeah, Dennis, in my experience, it's not always easy to tell when God wants us to sacrifice something and when the idea may be coming from somewhere else. Can you give some guidelines for how we determine when God wants us to sacrifice something and when he doesn't?
Well, the first caveat I would put down is that we have to think here not just in terms of something that I need to sacrifice, but more of a deeper heart attitude of entrusting my whole life to Christ, whatever that may entail. I think that's the heart of the issue. Now, how that works out, and he may call on you for specifics along the way, most of the sacrifices that God calls on us for make a lot of sense, like what John was describing there. I mean, it wasn't irrational to resist these demands from his company to expend his whole life on their thing, and instead to focus on his family and his ministry. You know, it made sense. And I'm sure, and I happen to know that John talked to some other believers and got some counsel on that. What did they think he was reacting too much here? And so that's always a good idea. If some people try to demonstrate a sacrificial attitude toward God in extreme ways, and history is replete with examples of this. There's one guy that lived on top of a pole for 30-some years to show his dedication for God. See, I don't see any call for that. I mean, God's not asking us to do anything bizarre like that. So I think it'll probably make terrific sense. It'll probably have a great deal of spiritual expediency. It'll be good for the kingdom of God, what we're doing. And it'll be good for our lives and the lives of the people around us. So I think it could be analyzed in that way. And if it's something completely irrational, let's just, you know, maybe I should give my new car to the next bag person I see walking down the street. I don't think that's the kind of sacrifice that Christ calls us to. Get some counsel. See if it fits with the biblical principles. See if it has expediency in the spiritual realm. In other words, is this going to advance the causes of Christ in some way in this world? Those kind of questions there. All right, so let's pray together before we break up. Lord, you're the only one we can trust in this way. Everything else will fail us. We know, God, that the logic of our world is to live for self-gratification and self-enhancement. And you teach us something very counterintuitive, God, to live for self-sacrifice and to live like you lived. That way you call us to, Lord, the way of life that Jesus lived, is really a life of love, and it's a life of trust in you. Tonight, God, we want to offer ourselves to you in a new way and to just reaffirm that we do trust you and that it's not a waste when somebody goes all out for Jesus Christ. That's not wasteful at all. I also pray, God, we know that this whole thing would just be crazy to someone if they don't know Christ in a personal way. It's only those that have met Christ that can really understand what she did on that day. And so I pray that there may be some here who haven't really met you in a personal way. I mean, maybe they've been a Christian in the sense that they went to church, but maybe they've never personally asked you to come into their lives. Perhaps tonight, Lord, people sitting right in this room will just decide to tell you from the heart, look, I'm trusting that Jesus' death has cleared the way between you and me. Come into my life. Make me a new creature, like it says. And let this aroma of Christ come out from me too. We pray it, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.